Dee Bright's Big Guests.
Multi-award-winning comedian Stuart Lee has just released a third series of his BAFTA award-winning programme, Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, on DVD. In the successful BBC series, Stuart continues to push the boundaries of stand-up comedy as he presents his unique take on six new subjects. We're going to find out what they are and find out all about what Stuart's up to. You know, he's one of our favourites. It's Stuart Lee. Yeah, yeah. We always have a nice little conversation before we open the mic. Should we say what we're talking about? Tim was complaining about
all kinds of things. No, I was complaining more about telecommunications companies. Stuart was complaining about gas.
Yeah, I was complaining about
post office.
A phone company also that called me up and asked me a security question but wouldn't answer my security question to them.
But how do we know who anyone is? I mean, there was a funny thing that happened on now remember MySpace in the old days of the internet?
Yes.
I was told I had to set up a MySpace because someone was pretending to be me on MySpace.
Right.
And so I looked at the me on MySpace. And the me on MySpace had got in touch with Eliza Carthy, the folk singer, who I knew anyway. And the Eliza Carthy on MySpace had said to the me on MySpace, "Oh, I really like your work, let's be friends." So I knew that wasn't her because she knows me anyway. So I thought, that's someone pretending to be me and someone pretending to be her.
Yes.
It formed a sort of online friendship, both unaware that neither of them are who they say they are.
It's almost like a parallel society, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that really means that even though we're in the business, we're kind of ordinary people as well. And
of course.
I think that that puts our feet firmly on the ground, don't
you think? Yeah, it does.
And it's okay to be grumpy, isn't it, a little bit?
Yeah, it's all right to be grumpy, yeah. But for the record, anyone online saying they're me isn't me. I don't do Twitter, I've got no Facebook. They're all people wading around causing trouble in my name.
And if they were you, they'd need to be funnier, wouldn't they?
It wouldn't be hard for the false me on Twitter to be funnier, as he has issued no tweets ever. He just sort of squats there.
I love it.
They probably assume it is me. I think that's what I would do.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
If you had to describe your style, your humour, because you're very difficult to define, actually, but how would you be described?
Well, it doesn't really work over short distances. I haven't got many one-liners. When I do write them, they come as such a surprise. Yeah. People barely notice that they've happened. I like to develop an idea, and often it's not always clear where it's going, or sometimes it's so obvious where it's going, the pleasure is in how long I take to get there.
Well, the fact that you go on about a subject too long, and that becomes the joke.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's sort of about how jokes work, but then a lot of stories that we like or films that we like or music that we like are about themselves, you know. The assumption was always that it was a bit inaccessible and up itself, but as the years go by, more people seem to get into it and like it, so...
Has it developed in the way that you thought it might, even going back to Lee and Herring?
Well, what has changed, and it changes quickly, is that I don't think the style and the material's changed, but my life's changing around me, which actually forces my hand. I don't go out and have adventures anymore or do anything socially or have any awareness of popular culture, because I've got children, I'm busy with that all the time. So that changes what you write
about.
That's
the old carpet remnant tour and everything.
That was that old show about that. And then another thing that's happened lately, I mean, you said at the beginning, award-winning, it would be dishonest to write in the way I have been, where I make out I'm this sort of neglected outsider figure, when these, you know, awards sort of pile up and you get the show's been recommissioned again for a fourth series and things like that. So actually that's something I've got to sort of figure out. What reason can there possibly be for you to be on stage in such a bad mood when things are going reasonably well?
Yeah.
And at the moment, I don't really know. That is sort of what I'm trying to work out. And I was sort of getting to it at the end of the series that's just out on DVD. I had an episode about the sort of monotony of being a dad.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of starting to sort of get there, because obviously that is a universal experience. It's not specific to me. So I don't know. The next series is going to be interesting. Who is doing it? I've got to work that out.
Do you find it difficult to deal, in a sense, with that success?
Yeah, I do. I was very grateful to get the BAFTAs and the British Comedy Awards last time around, because it meant the series got recommissioned, I think, because it was still in the balance at the time. But actually, for the act, it's sort of a bit of a weird thing. He wouldn't want to belong to any club that would have him as a member.
And how much would you say the Stuart Lee on stage is a performance?
Well, I didn't used to think it was, right? But increasingly, I do have to think it is, because I write a new show, 2 hours or whatever, and I tour it for much longer now, many more times than I would have done before. So it's not possible to get genuinely wound up about these things or upset every night. You have to create some sort of distance. And often I sort of think, What would he do now when something's happening in the room? And what he would do would produce something quite difficult that would make the show worse. Mm. And then I have to do that. Because I have to sort of do what he would do. Then I have to try and get him out of the mess that he's got the show into by like being really rude to someone. Or you know,
believe me, working in radio, we know exactly what you're saying.
You do it between yourselves, don't you? I mean, you can spark things off each other. A stand-up on my own, I have to kind of do that to myself. So I have to kind of split my brain and try and argue with myself and do things that annoy me so that I can come back from them, which is just sort of nuts, isn't
it? I'm sorry, I can hear people in my headphones saying, can you three shut up and play a clip? We'll be right back.
9 years ago, I've been married 1 year, and I went off on tour, and while I was on tour, I ran out of pants. Now, like a lot of men, I don't really know where my pants come from. I always seem to have loads, but I don't remember ever having bought any.
And there's more.
Tax breaks for married people are great, aren't they? They're worth up to £70 per person per year. With that money, you can buy an HBO box set and then you never need to talk to each other in the evenings.
Now we're back with Stuart Lee. Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle is what we're talking about. And also, I think we'll mention the tour, by the way, which comes up in January, Monday 5th of January to Saturday 31st of January at the Leicester Square Theatre in London. You like doing that one. That's downstairs, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's about a 450-seater. It's all on one level. You can see everyone. And there's a bar sort of in the room, so it feels like a club. And basically, if I do the show there for 2 months before I go on tour, then when I'm suddenly in these big, for me, rooms that I do now, the sort of 2,000 seaters, without that level of intimacy, you have at least run it in a place where you knew what it was like. So it's sort of, I mean, I don't quite know how people do it that hit the ground running in these stadium shows, because it's sort of, when you do those big rooms, I mean, I've only ever done benefits at them, really, but it's like listening to the sea in a shell or something. The noise of the audience is strange, kind of waves breaking on a shore. You know, you can't really feel the rhythm of it in the same way as in a smaller room.
On to February then, and that's Norwich, Colchester, Malvern, Warwick, Leicester, Salford, St Albans, Guildford, Brighton, and then Brighton again. And that's the end of January. And then March, it's Devon and Yeovil and Truro and Cheltenham and Cardiff and Chesterfield and Stafford, etc., etc. Check press for details. Going right through until June, so you're going to have a very busy year next year.
Well, this is me working out all the stuff. This will all end up being series 4 of Comedy Vehicle, which I film in December next year. So I kind of try and work it all out on the road so I know where the stresses and strains are. And then what was great about the last series is because I knew this stuff really well and I wasn't jamming it off an autocue, when things happened in the room, like people got up or joined in or said things, I was able to really improvise with it. And you don't really see that very much in comedy on telly, where someone abandons their routine to deal with something in a room. We managed to hang on to some of that. So it was nice to know it well enough to do that.
Well, this series that's out now, the Series 3, that's out on DVD, filmed at the Mildmay Club in northeast London. Yeah. And the series also features Kevin Eldon and Paul Putner, plus Stuart being taken to task on his ideas by script editor Chris Morris, as well as an interview with Canada's leading comic, Bacon Face. Now, this is a guy who has a bacon on his face.
Yeah. I saw him when I was a kid in Canada, when I was about 17, and I got him in to be a script associate on the series, which is a euphemism we use in stand-up for writer. And I saw him in Edinburgh 2 years back, and he did a month at the Stand, and they thought he was really above himself, because he said, I will need my own fridge backstage. And they thought he was, who does he think he is, you know?
That was his rider.
I know, but the fridge was actually, he can't...
For the bacon?
Yeah, because he could basically get about 5 shows out of 3 packs of bacon.
I mean, it's a great talking point, and I suppose in Canada, where they eat for breakfast, like a lot of crispy bacon, that wouldn't work.
No, just bacon he worked with. I mean, I don't know what... There seemed to be some trauma in his teenage years involving a prank where he lay naked in a clearing in a campsite and covered himself in bacon to surprise his friend, but whilst gone, a bear came in, and I think... Something happened involving the bacon that has led him to try and deal with this trauma by plastering it over his own face.
Oh, I see. So it's a healing process for him.
Well, a lot of comedy is the healing process. People don't seem to realise, but we're up there day after day trying to fix ourselves.
Yeah, I've opened you up now, haven't I? Hey? It's all coming out now. Anyway, listen, Series 3 of Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle is out. Did anybody write any of this down?
His most revealing interview.
It's out now on DVD. And the tour, as we say, kind of mini
tour,
is January. That's the mini tour. That's at one theatre. And then we've got February, March, April, May and June of next year for the Stuart Lee tour. Do you know what you're going to call it yet, the tour?
Yeah, it's called A Room With A Stew.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Wasn't my idea. It was actually the comic writer, Alan Moore, told me to call it that, and I thought that is a funny idea.
No, that is funny. Yeah. Good to see you again. Wish you a Merry Christmas.
Thanks for having us.
See you later.
Brilliant.
Stuart Lee. Thank you, Stuart. Let me just go back to the bacon thing. Now, and now it's Tim Smith and my good self, and we'd like to bring on some factoids, wouldn't we, Tim?
We would. Did you know that Elvis Presley was nearsighted? Did you know that?
I didn't know that. You make a hell of a noise, don't you?
He owned $60,000 worth of prescription sunglasses when he died, and the hit, the Elvis hit Hound Dog, was written, they say, in about 10 minutes flat.
What percentage of the world's wine bottles have screw caps, and what percentage do you think have the old cork caps?
Well, I think the screw caps is quite high now. 75%?
Are quite high.
Yes.
You said is quite high.
No, the percentage of screw caps is quite high.
No, but you got it wrong.
No. Listen very carefully. The percentage... I think is quite high. 75% screw caps, 25% corks.
No, it's 15% of the world's wine bottles have screw caps, and then obviously, what would that be, 85% have the other.
So horribly wrong. Yeah.
Sorry to correct you, by the way.
What do you think the American businessman Charles Kreters invented?
Was it lino?
No. It wasn't. It was large-scale commercial popcorn machines. He did it in 1893.
Oh, that's what I meant. Factoids. Well, now we have Henry Marsh, CBE, and just let me get a nice round of applause here, Henry. Let me just tell people about you. Henry Marsh, CBE, is one of the most senior and experienced neurosurgeons in the United Kingdom and has been a senior consultant brain surgeon at St George's Hospital in London since 1987. He pioneered the use of cortical mapping under local anaesthetic in the UK and remains one of Europe's most experienced surgeons in this field. Now, Do No Harm is Henry's first book, and it's the product of a lifetime's thinking and experience on the front line of healthcare. It's the first time a neurosurgeon has written so openly about their work, revealing the frustrations of life in a busy modern NHS hospital. So, were you a little reticent to put together this book? What were your thoughts when asked?
I wasn't very worried about it. I knew what I was doing was slightly unusual. It's been billed variously as confessions, but it's not a confession because I'm actually very proud of my work and the work of my hospital. But it's trying to give an accurate and honest account of the reality of one aspect of modern healthcare. And brain surgery is kind of extreme medicine. It's triple X surgery. It's very dangerous. And I wanted the public to understand that's what it's really like.
Let me ask you, how do you go about becoming a brain surgeon? I mean, when did you first know that that's what you might do?
Oh, I knew about 2 years after qualifying as a doctor. I'd wanted to be a surgeon, but I wasn't really quite sure what sort of surgery I wanted to do. And then by chance, I saw a brain operation, and it was love at first sight. And then it's about five and a half years of specialist training before I became an independent consultant.
Why did you like it so much? Why was it?
Because it was elegant, it was dangerous, it was important, it appealed to my sense of self-importance, is the honest answer. But just got me. I knew that's it. I felt, having seen that operation, I felt that's all I'd ever wanted to do all my life, but I hadn't roused it.
How many different kinds of brain tumours are there? I mean, you do go through all the different kinds in the book.
There are many, many different kinds. And the problem is the brain is the most complicated thing in the body. It's a cliché, but it's the most complicated thing in the known universe. Mm. And the range of tumours is very great. Some are good, some are bad, and some are halfway in between.
Well, I would have thought mainly they're bad.
Well, there is this saying, when the air hits your brain, you're never the same again. But it's not entirely true. You can cure some people completely.
And you also talk in the book about just not doing anything to some.
Well, this is, I mean, as you get older, what you realise, the real challenge in a lot of medicine, particularly the sort of medicine I do, is the decision making. And if you're dealing with very dangerous, difficult diseases like brain tumours, as of any operation, you have to decide, you know, what is the risk of treatment, what is the risk of doing nothing. Sometimes it's safer to do nothing. Sometimes it's kinder to do nothing. And when mistakes are made, and when I've made mistakes, they've been mainly in the decision-making, not my hands have slipped or I've dropped something or anything corny like that. It's the decision-making which is critical.
You talk about decisions when operating in the depths of one's brain. How do you know what, for example, is at the back of it. So you get to it and you find something else that you didn't see, that you didn't know before you operated.
The biggest change in neurosurgery and brain surgery in my career has been called imaging, is X-rays, MRI brain scans.
Yeah.
We have a much, much clearer idea of what's... I mean, it's still like looking at the universe through a pair of dirty binoculars in terms of the complexity of the brain. But in terms of surgery, which goes on at a fairly crude level compared to the underlying complexity of the brain, we have a pretty good idea from modern brain scans what's going on.
And what about this thing that most medics say that we use, what, only a quarter of our brain?
It's a myth. It's not true.
It's not true?
It's not true. No. If you measure brain activity when people are not consciously thinking of anything, the brain is still whirring away. Most of what goes on in our brain is unconscious. We're not aware of it, what's going on.
How do you know which parts of the brain operate this and which parts operate that?
Well, it's a historical question. The first discoveries were in the 19th century when people had head injuries or strokes. And then you could see if you made a hole in one part of the brain, it might produce a particular problem. And then in the modern era, you can actually expose the awake brain, as I do, for some operations, and then stimulate it with a little electrode and see what effect that produces, which gives you a rough map as to what bits of the brain do what. But we still don't know where memories are stored. We don't know what a thought consists of. Well, you have no idea what consciousness consists of.
And has there been progress in general brain surgery in the last 10 years, 20 years? Has it moved forward?
Well, it hurts me to say this as a brain surgeon, but basically progress in brain surgery is to make brain surgery unnecessary. And the real progress in my career has been interventional radiology, where rather than sawing people's heads open to fix a problem, you do it from microcatheters within blood vessels. And the other progress has been modern radiation, where you can get very high-dose radiation to treat small tumours. So that means a lot of the very dramatic, incredibly exciting surgery I was training to do 25 years ago is now no longer necessary. So it's good for patients, but bad for the self-esteem of brain surgeons.
And do people come up to you and, you know, when you're in conversation with people, do you have that thing, well, it's not brain surgery, and you say, yes, it is, actually?
My wife, Kate Fox, the writer, she texted me yesterday saying she was sitting on the train to Oxford and heard somebody who didn't sound terribly smart shouting down the phone, it's not rocket surgery!
Yeah. Henry's book, Do No Harm, Stories of Life, Death and Brain Surgery, is out now in paperback. Thank you very much. And also the best of your wife as well, Kate, because we've had her on. She's an author and does lots of other things as well, right? Henry Marsh, everybody, CBE. Thank you, Henry. I hope we asked the right questions.
Cheers.
Who knows? This is a great question, Tim Smith. We're back for Factoids. The last major Hollywood movie to be released on VHS.
Oh, cry. Dirty Dancing.
No. I'm not even sure if you know this movie.
Fatal Attraction.
No. Good guesses, though.
Give me a clue.
I don't think we're going to know it. It's called A History of Violence, 2006. Was that like a spoof film or something?
No, it was about the guy that was like undercover. He'd been some kind of hitman and he was living in small town America and he didn't want anybody to know his past.
And
it's the Danish actor. And I can't remember his name. Brilliant guy. No, it's not Jürgen. No. It'll come back to me. Okay. Do you like rhubarb?
Yes.
You think rhubarb's a fruit, don't you?
It's a vegetable and you have it with custard.
It's actually a close relative of garden sorrel. It's therefore a member, you're right, of the vegetable family.
Thank you very much. Do us another one while you're there, Tim.
On average in the UK, we eat roughly 1,200 chickens during a lifetime.
And cows given names produce more milk. Factoids. And now we've got somebody on the line who I'm so pleased to talk to. It's Peter Furman. And let me just tell you about Peter Furman. Peter is a TV illustrator, puppet maker and co-creator of The Clangers and Bagpuss. On Sunday evening, Peter will be presented with a special award at this year's British Academy Children's Awards. The award recognises an individual's outstanding contribution to children's media and the entertainment industry. This year, it'll be presented by Bernie Cribbins with a special introduction by Michael Palin, the event held at the Roundhouse in Camden, London. With long-term collaborator Oliver Postgate, Peter created the beloved children's TV programmes The Saga of Noggin the Nog, The Clangers, Ivor the Engine, Pogleswood and Bagpuss with Ivan Owen. He created the popular puppet Basil Brush with a real foxtail. I mean, Peter, this is incredible work that you've done, and congratulations on your forthcoming award.
Thank you very much, Steve. I've got a clanger with me to say a few words. Do you want to hear her say?
Yes, I do.
There you are. She said a few words.
I'm not sure. What did she say there, Peter?
Well, she was saying, isn't it amazing that you should be awarded this thing?
That's fantastic.
Now, actually, it's one of the little sentences that one of the clangers said at the opening of the clangers.
What's interesting is that things like the clangers, even Ivor the Engine and Bagpuss, they've become kind of a little bit surreal almost. I've been to universities and see students watching these things.
Yes, and I think the point about the clangers was, first of all, they weren't very appreciated. We didn't get a lot of feedback from young children, but apparently the students were going around with swanny whistles, making these swanny whistle noises.
You know, I was thinking, Bagpuss, they lived in that shop, and yeah, the shop didn't sell anything, did it?
No, it's really a shop to look after toys that were lost or damaged in some way, and Emily and the puppets would tell stories about them to create their sort of cure, and so they were mended and put back in the shop window. If anyone was passing who'd lost a funny little elephant with no ears, they could pick it up again.
Of course.
So it was all to do with magic. Apparently, Emily's, who's my youngest daughter, she says the real reason people liked Bagpuss so much was because there was a little girl with her toys in a shop and no adults around to interfere.
Yeah. I understand there's going to be another version of the clangers. What's that going to
It's going to look like the original series,
but
much better done, because Oliver was working on his own. Now, up in Manchester, they've got sort of several animators working with lots of puppets on several sets, so they can all be working on this and putting so much more detail in it. And for the first time, clangers can leap around and jump and hop and skip because they have clever techniques there now. And they've got a team of knitting ladies who've knitted them all.
Okay.
So they're still knitted, and they're going to be animated in single frames still, as it were. And we were dead against CGI sort of animation because it deadens things a bit. So you can actually look at them in brilliant sort of HD and see the actual knitting. And you could always imagine holding them. So they're so nice. But they're really good. They do 10 times as much as Oliver could have done, but still with the same feeling.
I love it. Well, Peter will be presented with the special award at this year's British Academy Children's Awards at the Roundhouse in Camden. Thanks very much for coming on the air and talking with us. It's a real privilege to talk to you. Keep doing it. That's in London on Sunday. And next June, a new version of The Clangers will be coming up on the CBBS channel. So that's all good. Thank you very much, Peter. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Peter Furman, goodbye. That's good. And now we're back for Factoids. What do you think, Tim Smith, the odds of being struck by lightning are?
1 in 6 million.
600,000 to 1. That's much lower than I thought.
Yeah.
And have you ever known anybody that's been struck by lightning?
No, I haven't, but I've read about people who've been struck by lightning, usually on a golf course.
Yeah, on a golf course and under a tree for some reason.
Sometimes under
right?
a tree, yeah. And of course, lightning does strike the same place twice.
Oh, yes, it does.
Absolutely, because you look at the Empire State Building or any high building, because they get struck quite often.
Which vitamin do you think rain has in it?
C.
No.
D. E.
No, think. I mean, it's not going to have D in it, because D comes from sunlight. It's not going to have C in it, because that comes from fruit.
Oh, yeah, you're right, actually, for once. A.
B12.
Factoids.
John Lloyd CBE is with us. He's here. He comes by every year. John Lloyd is an award-winning producer behind some of the greatest television comedies of all time, and certainly of the last 30 years, including Blackadder, Spitting Image, Not the Nightclub News, and QI. John has just written the fifth book based on the TV series QI, 1,411 Facts to Knock You Sideways. That's an unusual number. John co-wrote the book with John Mitchinson and James Harkin, and of course, the ever-inquisitive QI elves. The QI elves do really exist, and they're in the back room, aren't they?
They are. They're actually in my briefcase as we speak.
I didn't realise they were that small. So when the show is on and Stephen's out there and the comedians are there, are you there? The elves are there and then the people are there in front of magazines, books and on the internet, yes?
Yes, that's right. They're in a television gallery, as they're called. There's a little back office with a glass window, and that's called the producer's box, and that's where the elves go. They colonise my box, and I have to sit in the sound department. And my job on the show these days, Piers Fletcher produces it, my job is to do the funny buzzer noises.
That's a great job.
All day doing, because I trained in radio. You know how much I love radio, and it's my privilege and pleasure to do that. And it's a wonderful thing for the sound crew. If you get that big laugh on Alan Davis's buzz, you know it's going to be a great evening.
Yeah. And I think I saw you say the other day, it was in a documentary, if you're lucky enough to be in a job where you do have some fun, and you clearly have some fun on that show, and you've had some fun in your career and all the things that you've done, really. You have fun, don't you?
I do have fun, and QI is, of all the shows that you mentioned, QI is the one which is the nicest to be on. Everybody loves doing it, from the lighting director down to the runners. It's a really warm, friendly thing, and it's very interesting. You feel like you haven't wasted your afternoon.
Was it always going to work, QI? Or at the beginning, did they say, well, I'm not sure if this format's going to work or if that's actually going to interest people? Because it's an interesting format, isn't it?
Well, it's not really a format, is it, Tim, really? It's kind of just a bunch of people talking, and then for some reason this terrible klaxon goes off when you said something quite...
I did like to say that,
normal.
John.
But no, actually, when I took it to Jane Root, who ran BBC Two, and she liked the idea straight away, and the pilot was the best pilot I've made since the news quiz in 1977, which I also did. And it was just obvious, the minute that Stephen Fry... He didn't want to do it, he wanted to be captain of the Clever team, but I persuaded him, just for the pilot, would he please, please step in and just do it. And the minute he was in that chair, you thought, this guy was born to do this job.
And there are some rounds, aren't there, where you really get involved and you don't want somebody to be funny. I find this with QI and with the books as well. You think, well, no, don't be funny now. I just want to find out actually how that worked and what in that historical moment what actually occurred. And then other times you think, wow, who's going to come out with the funniest line?
When we made the very first show, I couldn't get it shorter than an hour. And I rang the controller and said, can I have an hour? And she said, don't be silly. There's no comedy show can last an hour. They're half an hour. That's what comedy does. But now it is commonplace, isn't it, to have these extra long versions, the three-quarters
of an hour. Yeah.
And QIXL, for the nerds, that's the one they like because you get a bit more information. Now, many people who come to the show, which runs usually an hour and three-quarters, sometimes 2 hours, often say it works as it is. It works live. You really should come along and hang out for an evening.
Yeah, that'd be great fun. Because it's all people we know anyway, and we know you a bit.
You could get us in, could you, John?
Yeah, I think we could slip you in. Oh, yes.
Oh, see, we
Mr.
Know
Funny
people.
Buzzer Noises has power.
We know the Mr. Funny Buzzer guy. We're coming back with John Lloyd in just a moment. Don't go away. John's here. John Lloyd is back with us with the QI book 1411 facts to knock you sideways. Some facts from the book. Well, in 2007, 210,000 Americans were injured by lawnmowers. See, now you don't get to know that stuff every day, do you? On D-Day, J.D. Salinger fought with six chapters of The Catcher in the Rye in his backpack.
I didn't know that.
That's very interesting.
Also, 40% of pedestrian crossing buttons in Manchester, they don't work. How do you know that? They don't work.
A nerd has been testing them, right?
Jimi Hendrix was a paratrooper. I like that. Winston Churchill was a druid.
Really?
It's this thing that the surprise and the joy of how odd everything is. Polar bears cannot be seen using night vision equipment.
Isn't that marvellous?
What is it against the law in the polar bear world? There's some factoids in here that we could possibly use. You're welcome to use some of our factoids. Are we welcome to use some of these occasionally when you're not looking?
I would be delighted and honoured, Steve, because you know it's all inspired by you, this series of books.
Yeah.
What we think about this book is, of course, it's fun. It's just for passes Christmas Day nicely. But actually, I really think you could teach this thing in schools, and we're increasingly getting letters from teachers say that what I do is I come in the morning and I stick a QI fact on the blackboard about, you know, neutrinos or Greek gods or something like that. And it gets the kids warmed up and interested and laughing already. And the rest of the lesson goes like a breeze.
There is a point on the show where you really go into depth about a particular subject. It's not just bullets and what have you. It's quite interesting, I think. And as you say, educative.
It's learning by stealth. You should not be watching QI and think, well, I'm really being educated. You should be enjoying yourself. I want to say one thing about the book, which is I think we sort of invented a new genre here, because if you doubt any of the facts or you think, well, I don't believe that or I'd like to know more, you go online, qi.com/1411, and there's a source finder. So you put in the page number of the book and up comes a page with all the sources instead of the facts. And you can click on that, and it'll tell you where we found everything. And there's months of extra reading there.
Wow.
So it's supported trivia. It's more than just one-liners.
I know that there's no name for the backs of the knees. I've known that forever, so I can't attribute it to anywhere. And maybe I got it off you.
That is a good thing, isn't
it? Write that down.
No.
Yes, so it's not attributable. So that's quite interesting that you have all attributable facts.
We are very, very careful about the research now, because QI is increasingly getting quoted as a source on things like Wikipedia. And if we make a mistake, my goodness, doesn't stuff come down on us like a ton of brick. information does date. There's a brilliant book came out last year called The Half-Life of Fact, and the idea is it's like uranium. It decays over a certain period. You can't tell which atom is going to decay first. Over a certain amount of time, half the uranium is gone. And it's the same with facts. So in medicine, for example, medical students are taught that within 50 years, half the information they're taught is true will not be true anymore. But they don't know which half. That's a bit worrying.
Because things change, obviously. Yeah. The situation's changed. That's interesting.
It's like your career decaying over the years.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's got a half-life all of its own. Yeah,
I think one of the things we said in one of the earlier books is the stomach ulcers, people used to think they were caused by stress or bad diet, but actually they're caused by bacteria. And two Australian scientists went on about this for 20 years, saying it's just bacteria. We can get rid of those. We can cure an ulcer in 5 minutes. They won the Nobel Prize for it quite recently.
John Lloyd's new book, 1411 Facts to Knock You Sideways, is out now, and you can see QI on Friday night at 10 p.m. on BBC Two. Thank you, John. John Lloyd, CBE, thank you very much.
Thank you, man.
1411 Facts to Knock You Sideways.
Thanks for downloading Steve Wright's Big Guests. Join Steve and the team weekdays from 2 on 88 to 91 FM, BBC Radio 2.